Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the intensifying crisis over Ukraine, with President Obama in Estonia castigating Vladimir Putin ahead of a NATO summit as the Russian leader doubles down in his determination not to allow Ukraine to fall into NATO's orbit. John Mearsheimer, Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Co-Director of the Program in International Security Policy at the University of Chicago and author of Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in International Politics, joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Affairs, Why the Ukraine Crisis is the West's Fault. Then we'll look into the possibility of Iran and Saudi Arabia working together to stabilize Iraq and contain the Islamic State that is bent on slaughtering Iraqi Shiites, who they consider heretics, and might well have designs on replacing the House of Saud as the custodians of Islam's holy shrines of Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia. Nada Hashemi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver and co-editor of The Syria Dilemma, joins us to discuss the roles of Saudi Arabia and Iran in the regional strategy to contain the Islamic State that President Obama is trying to organize. Then finally, we will offer a tribute to the great American reporter and writer Charles Bowden, who died on Saturday in New Mexico at the age of 69. He was the author of more than 20 books, among them Down by the River, Murder City, Ciudad Juarez, and The Global Economy's New Killing Field, and Dreamland. His friend and acclaimed Latino author Luis Alberto Uria joins us. He is a professor of creative writing at the University of Illinois Chicago and the author of Devil's Highway, which was a finalist for the 2005 Pulitzer Prize. We will discuss the border issues that Charles Bowden wrote about and fought for and against, the war on drugs, immigration reform, and the environment. And joining us now is John Mearsheimer, who is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. His books include The Tragedy of Great Power Politics and the bestseller The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. And his latest book is Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in International Politics. He has an article at Foreign Affairs, Why the Ukraine Crisis is the West's Fault. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Mearsheimer.
I'm glad to be here, Ian.
And if this situation in Ukraine wasn't tragic enough, I mean, for example, Angela Merkel apparently is quite heartbroken about what's happening because the Germans have made such efforts to build economic ties with Russia, and it's all sort of blowing up in our faces, and it all seems so incredibly unnecessary. And furthermore, the thing that I find so bizarre about it is that, you know, we expand NATO westward to the point where the Russians just can't take it anymore. And yet NATO itself is a paper tiger. It's a, as the Polish foreign minister said in that secretly recorded tape recording of him recently, he said membership of NATO is worthless. And yet we have caused all of this grief in the name of NATO.
Well, I think you want to be careful here. I think there's no doubt that we should not be expanding NATO to include Ukraine, because Ukraine is not a country that we're willing to fight and die for. You want to notice that as this crisis has unfolded, nobody has argued that the United States should use military force to intervene on Ukraine's behalf. This is a way of saying that this is not a vital strategic interest of the United States, and therefore there's no way NATO should be expanded to include Ukraine. But Poland is a different matter, and other countries in Eastern Europe are a different matter, because we have now included them in NATO, and that means that our credibility is on the line, and there's no way, if Poland, for example, or the Baltic states were attacked by Russia, we would not come to their defense, because, again, they are already in NATO, and they are therefore, by definition, vital strategic interests of the United States.
Well, indeed, they are subject to Article 5, which is what NATO used in to intervene in Afghanistan after the 9/11 attack. But I guess one of the things that I find ironic, I just spoke the other day with the defense analyst at Novaya Gazeta in Moscow, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, and he admitted that NATO is something of a fiction. However, he said it's perfect for the Russian generals because it provides them, you know, it's harmless. At the same time, it's the great excuse for their military budgets. And the same is true on our side, you know.
No, I don't believe that's true. I don't think that the Russians see NATO as harmless. I think the Russians, and this includes Putin and his associates, view NATO expansion as a mortal threat. And I think that's what's precipitating this crisis. If NATO was a paper tiger, we wouldn't have this crisis. It's very important to understand that NATO was an alliance that was arrayed against the Soviet Union from 1945 to 1989. It was a mortal enemy. It did not go away. And when the Cold War ended, it began to march eastward. And what we're talking about when we talk about including Ukraine in NATO is marching that military alliance, that former foe, right up to Moscow's doorstep. And again, Moscow sees that as a mortal threat and is not going to let it happen. And that's why it's in the process of wrecking Ukraine. Putin's basic view is that if Ukraine wants to join the West, if Ukraine wants to become part of NATO, I'm going to do everything I can to prevent that. And if it means wrecking Ukraine, I'll do it.
And indeed, he is doing it, and we don't seem to get it that this is his red line. I mean, that's the part of it that I don't understand is why. Well, I suppose the real issue here is how did this happen? How did we get to this point? Isn't this a failure of diplomacy to not to see this happening, not to recognize the sensitivities? And even, by the way, Henry Kissinger in his latest essay in the Wall Street Journal points out that we need to get over our exceptionalism and recognize other countries' security interests.
Ian, it's totally baffling that we pursued this policy from the beginning and that we don't understand what's happening now. The Russians have made it clear since NATO expansion was first put on the agenda by the Clinton administration in the mid-1990s that it was unacceptable to Moscow. And after 2008, when we began to push forward the idea of including Ukraine and Georgia into the alliance, the Russians made it unequivocally clear that this would eventually lead to a major crisis. And indeed, there was a war in August 2008 between Russia and Georgia over this very issue. The Russians have told us countless times that NATO expansion was unacceptable, especially into Ukraine. But nevertheless, we completely ignored them, and we behaved as if NATO expansion was not a threat to Russia, and that the United States was a benign hegemon, and that the Russians should recognize that. But of course, they didn't. But we didn't pay them any attention, and the end result is we have this crisis. Why we acted this way is really hard to understand.
And, John, I had Chaz Freeman out at the UCLA Hammer Forum that I moderate just about a week or so ago. And he was supposed to be President Obama's chair of the National Intelligence Council, but his appointment was vetoed by AIPAC, the Israel lobby. But he lamented the lack of diplomacy in the U.S. government. And when I pointed out that in trying to sort of be Pollyanna, I guess, that Putin and Obama talk on the phone a lot, or at least for long periods of time, he said that in itself is a failure. The heads of state shouldn't be on the phones all the time. The people below them should be sorting these problems out and seeing them coming. And that's what I find so extraordinary is that we had a neocon in there, Victoria Nuland, who's married to one of the uber neocons, and she totally screwed up this situation, perhaps exacerbated it deliberately out of her ideology. But it doesn't look like anybody was minding the store when we put Putin in a box with that zero-sum situation over Ukraine.
Well, I think it's more than that they weren't minding the store. As I said before, I think the basic problem is that they didn't understand what they were doing. And here I'm talking not just about the Obama administration, I'm talking about the Bush administration and the Clinton administration before that. NATO expansion has been going on since the late 1990s. It was 1999 that we brought in the first set of East European countries into NATO. And it's been going forward. We've had something of an open door policy since then. And again, it's been supported by three administrations. And none of these administrations, the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations, have understood the consequences of what they were doing. And lo and behold, it is now blown up in their face.
So you mean that they didn't notice what happened in Georgia? I mean, that was in many ways provoked by John McCain during a campaign. You know, this Shakespeare was a reckless guy. I mean, the idea that he could take on Russia was so absurd. And he got sucker punched by Putin. But the message was so clear. And the part that I don't understand is, if you don't understand that Russia values those military naval bases on the Crimea as their warm water ports, and if you allow Ukraine to join NATO as the landlord of the Russian ports on the Black Sea, you're asking for trouble.
I agree 100% that you and I both cannot understand why they didn't understand what was happening. But the fact is, they saw what happened in Georgia, but it just didn't register in their brains. And it had hardly any effect on how they thought about NATO expansion into Ukraine. And the best evidence of this is the fact that they were shocked by what happened after the February 22nd coup. Remember, it's after the February 22nd coup of this year that Putin goes into action and takes Crimea and then threatens to intervene and now has intervened in eastern Ukraine. Before that, there was no such problem. But when it happened after February 22nd, the Obama administration and most people in Western Europe were shocked. They couldn't believe it. And the reason is that they thought that NATO expansion was a benign move eastward, that it would not provoke the Russians, that they had done enough to assuage Putin's fears. And this, despite the fact that Putin had said it was unacceptable. And as you point out, we have evidence from the Russia-Georgia war of 2008 that this is unacceptable to the Russians. It really is baffling that American and European policymakers have pursued this boneheaded policy for so long. And by the way, once things began to go south after the February 22nd coup, we then foolishly doubled down and we're making a bad situation worse. We're getting tougher and tougher with Putin. And we're talking about, you know, deploying more NATO forces in the east, running NATO exercises in front of Russia. This is just going to provoke the Russians further and, again, make a bad situation worse.
But at this point, it does seem that we are locked in something of a Cold War tit-for-tat cycle, where the U.S.'s NATO is meeting in Wales on Thursday, and ahead of that, the president in Estonia is castigating the Russians for their military involvement. Again, as the military analyst in Moscow pointed out to me the other day, that the West just doesn't get it, that Putin is not going to give it up. You know, you have crossed a red line as far as he's concerned, and we still don't seem to get it. But what worries me is that we are in a cycle of tit for tat, and this idea of a 5,000-man rapid reaction force, again, you know, seems to me a bit farcical, but it's certainly heading in the wrong direction. Is there a possibility, do you think, that Obama can do a Nixon and do a reversal and do what you're arguing in your foreign policy article, John Mearsheimer, about why the Ukraine crisis is the West's fault, and using the example of Austria being a buffer during the Cold War, a neutral buffer, that just to stop this madness and just to say, okay, you know, let's all get together, all of these border states, work out a modus vivendi and stop this insanity?
Well, I think, as I make clear in the article and as you stipulated, the key to solving this problem is to turn Ukraine into a neutral buffer state, to make sure it's neither pro-Russian or pro-Western, and that it remains as a buffer state between Russia on one side and NATO on the other. And by the way, this is pretty much what Ukraine was from 1992 up until earlier this year. It was effectively a neutral buffer state, although the West was trying to pull it out of Russia's orbit, and that's what caused this mess. But what we ought to do now is work to turn it into a neutral state. Now, the question you raise is that a viable strategy given how far down the road we've gone? I'm not sure. I don't think that NATO and what's going to come out of this meeting in Wales is going to do anything to help the situation. In fact, as you implied, it will probably make the situation worse. I think if there's any hope, it lies with the Germans. I think the Germans, by and large, understand what's going on here. And I think that with the passage of time, it is possible that the Germans will push very hard to get some sort of diplomatic solution and to reverse course. I don't think you can put much faith in the Americans. The American foreign policy establishment, the American media, is just much too hawkish on this issue to allow Barack Obama to have maneuver room to turn the ship around. But I think if the Germans and the Europeans more generally begin to see the light, and there is evidence that they are, then slowly but steadily we can move in the other direction and hopefully settle this one. But again, I wouldn't bet a lot of money on that.
But I guess the problem here is that we crossed the Rubicon. I mean, I'm reminded of the prelude to World War One. In fact, the forum that I did recently with Chas Freeman was framed on When Diplomacy Fails, about the lead-up to World War One, and there's a best-selling book out now called The Sleepwalkers about this, and it feels like we were sleepwalking, even though, as you point out, the expansion of NATO was, in fact, our central policy, but one that had never been challenged, thought about, or understood in terms of Russian perceptions. And that goes back, though, to the Cold War, doesn't it? That we never understood how the other side saw us. We saw ourselves as being virtuous. They saw us as being a threat. That lesson has never been learned.
Well, I think that great powers tend to see each other as threats in almost every context. And that's why it's very important to make sure you don't take steps that reinforce that tendency. There was no question that given the collapse of the Soviet Union, that Russia would over time worry about its position in the world, worry about the balance of power, worry about threats from countries like China and the United States. And instead of taking those concerns into account, what the United States effectively did starting in the mid-1990s was take advantage of Russian weakness and push NATO expansion down their throats. And of course, given the tendency of great powers to do worst-case analysis about the other great powers in the system, this just only fueled that phenomenon and made a bad situation worse. And that's where we are today. And I think it's going to be very difficult at this point in time to reverse course and sort of win back some trust from the Russians. I think Putin probably has crossed the Rubicon, but one never knows.
Well, this is what I think is so tragic about it, is that it was so unnecessary to put him in this situation. And now that he's crossed the Rubicon, and particularly with the level of support that he has, I don't think we recognize how popular what he's doing is in Russia, albeit that he has total control of the media and nationalism is going up into the red zone on the meter. So I don't know how he walks that back. Isn't that a concern?
Yeah, that is a concern. But the counter to that is that there are significant economic costs for Russia in pursuing the present course. And one could make an argument that if we can get some sort of settlement and we can end our sanctions on the Russians and the Russians can end their sanctions on us and the Europeans, that this will be a huge boon for the Russian economy. You want to remember that they are paying a price, and that price will only go up with time. And that gives us leverage, if we're smart enough, to back off and work for neutrality. So I think you could make an argument that using those economic levers, you can go a long way towards turning the ship around in the water, although it's not going to be done quickly.
Well, I was just reading a piece, John Mearsheimer, from an analyst in Moscow who was sort of pretty much sharing my sentiments that this is tragically unnecessary what is happening, and this is damaging U.S. or Western and Russian relations, but they will eventually be healed over the long term, because this analyst and I think others in Russia feel this way, and I think it's part of Russia's geopolitical outlook. At the end of the day, I think, aren't they more concerned about the rise of China, and they feel at the end of the day that maybe the U.S. and Russia might need to work together?
Yeah, I think that that's true, but that's at the end of the day, and we have a long way to go.
We have a long way, I agree. But,
and we could do a lot of damage in the meantime, and that's what's happening now.
Right.
I think eventually with the rise of China, and this assumes that China will continue to rise in impressive ways, that the United States and Russia will both be interested in working together to contain Chinese power. But that's a long way off. And in the meantime, the Russians are being pushed by the West into the arms of the Chinese.
Right.
If anything, relations between China and Russia have improved markedly in recent months because of what we are doing with regard to Ukraine. So this is really a boneheaded policy. I would also note, Ian, that we need Russian help with regard to the Iranian nuclear program, with regard to Syria, and with regard to getting our troops and our material out of Afghanistan. Russia has been a valuable ally for the United States in a whole host of ways over the past decade or so. And picking a fight with them and driving them into the arms of the Chinese and threatening the possibility that they will continue to cooperate with us on Iran, Syria, and Afghanistan is really a boneheaded policy.
Well, it's a boneheaded policy that's compounded decades of boneheaded policies. I mean, we spent trillions on winning, in quotes, the Cold War and wouldn't pony up chump change to secure the victory with Russia when they most needed us in that transition. We were absent. And now we've really thrown gasoline on the fire with this unnecessary confrontation over Ukraine. So that's the tragedy, I think. It's part of a longer tragedy, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think this is a case of our foolish policies finally blowing up in our face. I mean, we got away with NATO expansion in 1999. That's when the first tranche took place. And then we got away with it in the mid-2000s when the second tranche took place. But since then, things have gone very badly, and this policy has, in effect, blown up in our face, much the way our policies in the Middle East are now blowing up in our face. We thought we could topple Saddam Hussein, and then we thought we could take down Assad in Syria, and that everyone would live happily ever after. And even as late as 2011, when we finally left Iraq, we thought we had ultimately succeeded. But, of course, we had not, and it's now all blown up in our face.
Well, John Mearsheimer, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with John Mearsheimer, who's the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the possibility of Iran and Saudi Arabia working together to contain the Islamic State.
Rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in? بعيونهم نوى النظر رماني من دحق عليهم نوى النظر رماني جيتني بجوز عيونه حارس مار الحنطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book, co-edited with Danny Postel, is The Syria Dilemma. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thanks, Ian.
And what's your sense of what's going on behind the scenes here between the two antagonists in this Cold War going on in the Middle East, a surrogate war, if you will, in Iraq and in Syria between Saudi Arabia and Iran? It looks as if, well, if they're not burying the hatchet, they're certainly thinking about it. And there was a meeting between the Iran's deputy foreign minister and Saudi officials a few days ago in Saudi Arabia. What's your reading on what's happening? Because it seems to me that both sides have recognized that the Islamic State, obviously it doesn't take much for the Iranians to recognize how the Islamic State wants to slaughter their fellow Shiites in Iraq as heretics. And it also would seem that maybe the Saudi Arabians are waking up to the possibility that the Islamic State might well want to take over the holy shrines of Mecca and Medina.
The rise of the Islamic State, Ian, I think is a major turning point in the contemporary politics of the Middle East. And it's within a couple of months over the past summer, led to a new alignment of political interests among regional actors who previously were at war with each other, not officially, but there is and has been a longstanding Cold War between Iran and its allies in the region and Saudi Arabia and its allies in the region. But now for the first time, they find themselves, as you just indicated, lining up together, facing a common threat, and that, of course, is the rise of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, as it was formerly known. So I think the meeting in Riyadh between the Iranian and Saudi foreign ministers is precisely meant to try and resolve and to see whether there's any common ground in terms of fighting this new threat. I remain skeptical, at least in the short term, of Iran and Saudi Arabia agreeing to coordinate policy, largely because, at least for the last decade, there has been a lot of deep animosity and anger and conflicting agendas that have dominated the foreign policies of these two countries. And so that history can't simply be ignored, notwithstanding the threat that ISIS poses to both of these countries in the wider region.
Well, in particular, Saudi Arabia, there's an interesting essay by Alistair Crook, the former MI6 official, that suggests that the real agenda of the Islamic State is to take over from the House of Saud and control the holy shrines of Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia, just as Wahhab did in the 18th century, in a sense. And they do seem to be really sort of demonstrating to the world how much they are faithful followers of Wahhabism, not the least of which is their displays of beheading infidels. And that seems to me to be it's both a incredibly scary concept, but also an incredibly credible one.
Well, you know, I think Alistair Crook's sort of piece in the Huffington Post is a very important piece. I think he, you know, gets some things right and he gets other things wrong. I think what's valuable about the piece, and I encourage, you know, your listeners to read it, is he does highlight the role of Saudi Arabia in terms of contributing to the radicalization and the rise of these extremist Sunni militant movements of which ISIS is a part of. In other words, I think the Saudi roots of the rise of ISIS have been largely ignored in the mainstream Western media debate. And I think one of the things that we're seeing right now is something that Middle East scholars and people who've been involved in Middle East politics have known for a long time, that the particular brand of Islam that has been promoted and disseminated in Saudi Arabia from the time of the founding of that kingdom in the early 20th century until today has been a very puritanical, extremist, anti-women, anti-minorities interpretation of Islam. And that's precisely the interpretation of Islam that we see being manifested in the behavior of ISIS and the Islamic State. In other words, this whole, you know, interpretation, this warped interpretation of Islam that encourages the beheading of enemies, the forced conversion of minorities, the subjugation of women, these things that we've been seeing that have been documented and we're just sort of getting a sense of how bad it's been, that comes straight out of the playbook of Saudi Wahhabism. And Saudi Arabia has been promoting this interpretation of Islam throughout the Muslim world from the time that it discovered oil and it became a major oil producer. And no one really has done much about it, largely because there has been a longstanding, you know, political alliance between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the West.
particularly the United States post-World War II, and also with Europe, because Saudi is a major oil producer. They invest the revenues that they get from oil in the European and American economies. But this interpretation of Islam that we, you know, have seen and sort of, you know, have been dealing with post 9/11, because in 9/11, you know, the worldview of the Al Qaeda operatives was basically cut from the same sort of Wahhabi interpretation of Islam. But now it's deeply informing, you know, the behavior and the practices of this particular group of actors that have caught all our attention, the Islamic State. So I think in that sense, you know, the existence of this particular family in Saudi Arabia, the social sort of contract that has existed between the House of Saud and the ruling Saudi religious establishment for many years that has allowed this type of interpretation of Islam that is decidedly, you know, puritanical in its essence to proliferate is now manifesting itself in very ugly ways. And so I think in that sense, you know, the Saudi Wahhabi roots of the Islamic State need to be given their fair shake, need to be given their fair attention. And so in that sense, I think Alistair Crook is right in drawing our attention to this particular dimension of the problem. I do disagree with his argument that the immediate, at least, goal of the Islamic State is to capture the holy places in Saudi Arabia. I'm sure they would love to do so, but there's no indication yet in any of the documents or speeches given by the leadership of the Islamic State that that's their intended target. I think they're really trying to consolidate land and draw upon support from people in Iraq and Syria and those foreign fighters that have flocked to them. But I suspect that if they were allowed to continue in this path, eventually they will turn to Saudi Arabia. But that's not an immediate issue on their agenda as far as I can see. So that's where I disagree with Alistair Crook's very insightful piece. But he does draw our attention to the very destructive role that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has played in terms of really polluting and disseminating a very warped and puritanical interpretation of Islam that is now manifesting itself before the eyes of the world, and many people are paying a price.
No, I obviously, you know, this is a kind of a Mad Max phenomenon, and you know, frankly, there's not a lot between where the Islamic State is now in Iraq and Saudi Arabia. It's just an open desert, but that's a long way off. That's not to say that aspirationally ISIS's real target might be the Hejaz, the seizure of Mecca and Medina, because they I think, are a lot of puritanical Wahhabis and Salafists do question the legitimacy of the House of Saud. After all, it was Osama bin Laden that threw his passport in the king's face because he felt that allowing the Americans in the war against Saddam Hussein to recapture Kuwait delegitimized the Sauds for as custodians of the holy shrine. So
yeah,
it's in the kind of DNA of Salafists, isn't it, about who is the legitimate custodian, and that's what the House of Saud have tried to do in this two-faced way. On the one hand, the princes have their hookers and billions stored abroad, but on the other hand, they use these pious religious police to keep everybody in line.
That's correct. I mean, I think one way of understanding this topic is that politically speaking, there is a big difference between the House of Saud in Riyadh and the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria today, and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. So politically, they have clear differences. The Saudi kingdom is allied with the West. They want to sort of modernize the kingdom within the confines of Saudi culture. But religiously and theologically speaking, and I think this is the point that Alistair Crook was really trying to highlight, theologically speaking, there is very little difference between the practice and the interpretation of Islam that we see in Iraq and Syria today under the rubric of the Islamic State and what's happening in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It's the same form of puritanical, ultra-conservative Wahhabi doctrine that is inherently anti-minority, particularly anti-Shia, anti-women, you know, is extremely violent in terms of how it manifests itself. So I think that's the key fault line here between the politics of these different groups, which differ significantly in terms of their agenda and their vision and their view of international relations, versus the theological compatibility and, in fact, symmetry between the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia and the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria.
But obviously, the beheadings of the two American journalists, you know, they are clearly punching above their weight in terms of, what, 10,000 fighters controlling all that territory and having all of these ambitions that we're talking about. But, you know, it just shows you how much we get whipsawed by these obscure players in the Middle East, whether, you know, it's Sirhan assassinating Bobby Kennedy, who would have been president, whether it's Ayatollah Khomeini essentially destroying Carter's presidency and allowing for the election of Ronald Reagan, whether it's Saddam Hussein becoming the bete noir of George W. Bush, and then later, after 9/11, Osama bin Laden, and now you have the Islamic State. And frankly, Nader, if and when they behead the 26-year-old young American woman they're holding, who's a humanitarian aid worker, they captured ISIS. You know, the reaction's going to, I mean, even Rand Paul, who's just a few days ago was castigating Hillary Clinton as a war hawk, has had to turn around and basically say he opposes the Islamic State and wants the U.S. to start bombing them.
Right. And so if there's another American hostage or Western hostage that's beheaded, the pressure on the White House and on the West, broadly speaking, to do something will increase simply by virtue of the barbarity of the beheadings that are taking place. But the question that I think we have to all deal with here is, you know, what can be done effectively to deal with this menace of the Islamic State? And I think there is no, you know, easy fixes here, because the problems and the roots of this particular phenomenon go very deep into the, you know, the politics of the modern Middle East. We've just been talking about one dimension of it, one that's been largely ignored in the media debate, and that's the Saudi Wahhabi roots of this phenomenon. But the other, you know, components of the ISIS crisis, as one person termed it, is really the, you know, the failure of politics across the Middle East. It's not a coincidence that Iraq and Syria today is where the world's attention is being focused and where the Islamic State has been able to establish control of territory. Those are the two countries whose politics in the modern period of Middle Eastern history has been the most catastrophic in terms of human rights violations and the absence of democratic rule. In other words, the dictators, the post-colonial dictators in Iraq and Syria really devastated those societies. And it's in the context of a broken, devastated society that radical extremist religious cults such as the Islamic State can gain a following. When the state is broken down, when there's a lot of disillusionment, you know, there's been a lot of talk about these foreign fighters that have gone to be part of the Islamic State, but the vast majority of the adherents of the Islamic State come from, you know, Iraq and Syria, people who have suffered, societies that have been suffered tremendously as a result of the corrupt and brutal, tyrannical rule of post-colonial dictators, but also in the case of Iraq, the 2003 American invasion, which just sort of added to the misery that Iraqi society had been facing under Saddam Hussein. So I think, you know, one has to realize that sort of history of broken politics in the Middle East is a history that took many years to get to this point, and there's no quick fixes. A few bombing raids on ISIS targets in Iraq and Syria is not going to solve this problem. You might be able to defeat ISIS or the Islamic State in the short term, but another form of this radical group will emerge unless there is, you know, I think a longer-term strategy that's put in place. So I think we're dealing with an issue here, a problem that's going to be with us for the foreseeable future.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Nader Hashemi.
Happy to be with you.
We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with a tribute to the late and great American reporter and writer Charles Bowden.
اكتب وخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي وعسيني
He summoned all of its strength and climb It suffered all of its strength in the fall Sometimes when he got into fighting, man, he could fight with you all day long. He was a good man, and now he's gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Luis Alberto Uria, who is a professor of creative writing at the University of Illinois Chicago and a critically acclaimed and best-selling author of 13 books, who has won numerous awards for his poetry, fiction, and essays, and has been inducted into the Latino Literary Hall of Fame. His books include The Devil's Highway, which was a finalist for the 2005 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, and Queen of America, a novel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Luis Alberto Uria.
Hi, Ian.
And we're talking because we both knew the great Charles Bowden, who died on Saturday in New Mexico at the age of 69. I can only claim to have interviewed him a couple of times here in the studio and talked to him on the phone a few times. You obviously, as we say in Australia, bent the elbow over a few beers with him. What a character, what a great, authentic American he was.
He was a mad, wild, rocky soul. I'll give him that. And, you know, I found myself thinking, I'm getting interviewed so much about Chuck's death that it feels like a prank of his from beyond the grave, you know, a way to force me to discuss how wonderful he was over and over again.
Well, but he... I mean, he was just a ruthless truth teller, and he didn't suffer fools. He didn't suffer political correctness or political equivocation, did he? I mean, that's what I liked about talking to him about the border and his books and the work that he did.
No, he was a character in some ways. He was a baffling guy, you know. I mean, he was a gruff, tough. No nonsense, as you say, wouldn't suffer fools gladly. But underneath it all, there was a tenderness and a lyricism to him. You know, I mean, he was an avowed gardener. You know, he would be as insanely moved by a fresh crop of California poppies, you know, as he would have been by his more hard bitten, rough and tumble stuff. And I think he, you know, though he was a truth teller, I think he was also enamored of the myth, and you know, a lot of us who knew him have said he definitely reflected a kind of a Nietzsche, you know, stare into the abyss and the abyss stares into you. I think if you go to such a pitiless place for your daily bread, it makes it a little hard to carry on. So he gave us all the impression that he would, at the same moment, live forever and suddenly explode like old munitions and be gone. But I don't think anybody really believed Chuck Bowden would ever die.
Well, of course, he was best known for his incredibly thoroughly researched books about the borderland and the failed war on drugs, and particularly, of course, the Ciudad Juarez, the Murder City, as his book was titled. Down by the River, of course, an earlier book, Murder City, and Dreamland. We are talking to him more recently because I'm curious to know about his feelings about what has been happening recently with this influx of children from Central America.
You know, I don't know. He suffered some personal difficulties and left the Tucson area and went to New Mexico. And, you know, I had heard through friends, we have had a lot of mutual friends in El Paso, what he was doing. He no doubt had some pretty trenchant views about it. I mean, we both worked the border for a long time. That's how I got to know him. I had done my first book was about people living in the Tijuana municipal garbage dump, right on the shadow side of the Mexican fence. And, you know, he always had a ferocious rage about the fate of the children in particular. And, you know, and he would be relentless, I think, in his drive to find things. And he would find hauntings that no doubt, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's a trove of material about this very issue in his home at this very moment. But, you know, he would do things like go find the dump sites out in the desert where the immigrants were forced to shed all of their clothes and change out of what they were wearing, and he would go through their backpacks. And I remember him being moved to angry tears because he found someone's homework in a little backpack in the middle of the desert.
Well, of course, unfortunately, too many bodies have been found in the middle of the desert.
Mm, yeah, bodies, that was partially his stock and trade. I think if you're going to deal with, you know, these issues, that's it's inescapable. And the irony of this, for example, wonderful boondoggle of the border fence, which, you know, it wasn't lost on Chuck that one could go to that fence and, you know, walk a quarter of a mile and then have miles of open desert beyond the end of it. And, you know, he understood fairly well that how the politics went, how the personal politics went. And he was pretty fearless. I mean, he would talk to anyone from, you know, military, border patrol, undocumented person to smugglers and then the actual drug kingpins. He was completely fearless in that way.
And, of course, being in Tucson, he's not too far, is he, from the border?
No, he was always, I mean, you know, that was his beat. And, you know, certainly he, I think, found a kind of a mecca in El Paso because he was really close, and he was really close to the worst part of the border then. But, yeah, I mean, I found him initially through loving desert writings. I was a desert kid myself, and, you know, he and Edward Abbey were two big pillars for me, and I couldn't have been more flabbergasted when he hunted me down. I was like, oh, my God, Charles Bowden calling me? Really? And, you know, as I started moving toward more reporting work about that area, he was a great inspiration, you know. Certainly gave you something to try to live up to. You know, I don't know if I could have lived the, you know, the mythological life he lived. I think he had a real eye on, like I said earlier, on the myth and the legend. So there was more than a little bit of Hunter S. Thompson in him as well.
Well, that's what I was so taken by, is that Charles Bowden, of course, an extraordinarily prolific author of 20 books, and, of course, perhaps the best known is Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. And, of course, I think the most recent was Dreamland. You mentioned that, you know, you described this sort of craggy, raspy voice. But what I found most appealing is that he represented, at least to me, a kind of era in American journalism that we don't have anymore, these tough-minded anti-establishment types.
Oh, yeah.
That,
oh,
you know, it used to be, you know, that used to be what journalism was about. You know, it was about comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. And nowadays it's become about comforting the comfortable and afflicting the afflicted. And, you know, if you go.
I saw somebody had posted something about him online and called him a muckraker. And I thought, well, you know, I think he would have appreciated that. Because he was, for all of his sort of new journalism veneer that people thought he had, I think he was very old school. He was a hardcore, you know, two-fisted drinking, chain-smoking news junkie. And he would have, I think, complained immediately about being called a journalist. He didn't like that. That was a little too boutique-y for his taste. He was a reporter. And, you know, his ethos, I mean, it was very clear that reporters are like firemen. Reporters are like ambulance drivers, and they rush into the trouble. When there's trouble, when there's a crisis, they rush in heedless of you know, what might happen and the ramifications, and they go into the trouble. And he did. He did see it, I think, as an important job to bring some affliction to the comfortable. You know, I remember still being at a conference, a news people's nonfictionist and journalist conference. It was a black tie event. You will appreciate this, having known him. Everybody was there in their tuxedos, and I was spying on Dan Rather. I thought this was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. Dan Rather, you know, in a tuxedo. And here came Bowden. He was in blue jeans and a denim shirt and some kind of jacket. And I said, Chuck, this is a black tie event. He's like, yeah, I wore a bolo tie. That was his dress-up. And then the next thing I knew, he was being dragged out of the building by Secret Service because Justice Alberto Gonzalez had appeared, and Bowden was so furious about the Bush adventures in Iraq and Abu Ghraib and all this, he was yelling, murderer, fascist, killer. He was the only one. And I think he looked around at everybody as though all of these reporters were going to jump into the fray with him, and they basically sipped their white white wine and watched him be dragged off by the feds.
Yes, heavens forbid that you confront your sources and tell them like it is and lose access to the great and powerful, you know.
He was fearless in those ways. Right. And, you know, I think it could be harrowing for even friends, you know. I mean, he had a different view, I think, of Mexican border culture than I did, since I was born in Mexico and have a lot of love for it as well. And I think he truly could no longer see any hope in it. And so, you know, he and I were put on conferences together a few times, and he would often interrupt my talk and say pretty mean things. But it was Chuck, and I understood where it came from. I was talking once, and we were on a huge panel, and I was talking about the hope inherent in the border, and that, you know, it's not all slaughter, it's not all hatred. There is a long tradition of fraternity and hope on the border. And in the middle of my talk, he leaned into his mic and said, "I don't know what planet you're from." And I just, it was hilarious. I could, you know, that was Chuck. And at another time, we were in Oregon, in Bend, Oregon, and we were on a panel with Patricia Smith and Ursula K. Le Guin. I mean, it was this really highfalutin panel, and I again was trying to explain some of my own family's history and, you know, what one could hope for at the border, and Bowden just said into his microphone, "Oh, God." So he could be tough to be friends with.
Sure. Now, you mentioned Ed Abbey, who I guess was both a colleague and a mentor to some extent,
yeah,
of Charles Bowden. I was reading a piece by you, Luis, where you said that you asked Chuck about his late friend Ed Abbey, and he started to weep and said, "Oh, hell," and left the bar.
Yeah, it was one of the most stunning moments I've ever experienced with a fellow writer, I will say. I mean, you know, you have to understand that Chuck was one of my heroes, and, you know, I was in San Diego at the time, and he called me out of the blue when my first book came out, and he was so generous and funny. I thought, well, I'm going to go to Tucson and meet this guy. Are you kidding? You know, and I drove to Tucson. Like I said in the piece, he met me at a hotel bar on Speedway in Tucson, and he had a Mexican federal agent retired bodyguarding him because there were narco assassins hunting for him at the time. Allegedly, anyway. I don't know how much of this was, you know, fear and loathing in Las Vegas territory or what, but he was in the bar, backed into a corner with walls against his back, and this armed Mexican federal drug agent standing near him, watching everybody. And so I thought, this is going to be the coolest beer I've ever had in my life, right? And we started talking, and it was a really fun and interesting talk. And I realized that, you know, one of the things about Chuck that people probably don't know is what a ferocious historian he is. I mean, or was, sorry. He, you know, he knew his history, and he knew his Mexican Revolution and border history front and back, and he studied it all the time. So we were talking about these things, and we were talking about his life as a writer in Arizona. And I knew that Ed Abbey had been very important to him, and I asked him, "So can you tell me a little bit about Ed?" And he just stared at me. I said, "You know, I love Ed's work, and I understand, you know, he was kind of hard on Mexicans, but I swallowed that pill, and can you tell me what he was like?" And his eyes brimmed up, and he actually started to cry. Tears fell down his cheeks, and he just looked at me and said, "Oh, hell, man." And he got up and walked away, and he was gone. That was it.
Well, Luis Alberto Illia, of course, people know Charles Bowden from his novels and his writing, his 20 books, particularly Down by the River, Murder City, and Dreamland, but they probably don't know how much of an environmentalist he was. And he did do a photo book on the Sonoran Desert, and he was a very passionate environmentalist. Let me just read a little passage here by Charles Bowden, his plea for the environment. "We are at a crucial moment in the commission of a crime. Our hand is on the knife. The knife is at the victim's throat. We are trained to kill. We are trained to turn the earth to account, to use it, market it, make money off it, to take it for granted. Logically, we will never be able to reverse this part of our culture in enough time to stop that knife in our hand. But that is the task at hand, to cease this act of violence. Great writer, really.
Boy.
And a great environmentalist and a man of the border, right? Was he? Do you think he was between somehow? Can you be between two cultures? Between?
I think so. I mean, one of the things that he, I think, probably wrestled with was that he would sort of forever be an alien visitor to the south of the border realms. But I think he also embraced, at least he said so in conversation, the fact that anyone who comes into the American West, and certainly the Southwest, is an invasive species, and that he was used to it. I mean, he was from back here originally, and he said in one of his books that he was really attracted to the frenzy, was really attracted to the turmoil and the struggle in the deserts, that those things are peeled raw and obvious for us to see. And I do think that his ferocity and his roughness and even his whiskey, were fueled by a sense of love and a sense of mourning. I think he was genuinely mourning what was happening to the world. And if one does embrace him as an environmental writer, which is how I first found him and always saw him, I think part of his point was that we are nature as well. We, one doesn't just have to write about bighorn sheep. We are there with them. And, I think he was driven to distraction. Remember, like I said, he was an outdoorsman. He was a gardener. He was also, the myth of who Chuck Bowden was, but he not only liked to write about the Border Patrol, but he liked to hike out where they patrolled and pitch a tent, and they, according to him, would bring him beer.
Yeah, who needs water in the desert, right?
I tell you, when Devil's Highway came out and we talked about it, he said, "Hell, man, the Border Patrol, they bring me beer and helicopters." He wasn't impressed.
Well, Luis, it's great to talk to you, and
to you,
I wish we weren't having to talk about this great guy that just passed. But he's worthy of as much attention as we can give him, frankly.
Yeah, I hope his books take off yet again. That's all he would want. He would want you to have his book on your shelf, seriously, and I don't think he would even care about being mourned.
Well, again, I've been speaking with Luis Alberto Urrea, who's a professor of creative writing at the University of Illinois Chicago and a critically acclaimed and best-selling author of 13 books. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.